Seinfeld, Friends, Frasier, ER, Cheers, Law & Order, Will & Grace, Mad About You, and Third Rock from the Sun. Former NBC President of Entertainment Warren Littlefield headlines this insider's account of a great era in television history with all kinds of juicy and hilarious details by the actors, writers, directors, producers, and network executives who made it happen. He does it in his new book, Top of the Rock, Inside the Rise and Fall of Must-See TV. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Warren Littlefield to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
It's wonderful to be on the phone with you, Joe. Thank you.
Give us a sense of how one becomes a president of entertainment for a major network.
A lot of luck. When I started at NBC, I was in comedy development, and NBC had the stellar lineup of Different Strokes and Hello, Larry. That was it. ABC had 14 comedies. CBS had a dozen. There was nowhere to go but up. And fortunately, I had a little something to do with The Cosby Show, Golden Girls, and those really helped propel me up the ladder at NBC.
As was stated in an early episode of The Larry Sanders Show, when one network executive came in and said, "Hello, Larry," Gary Shandling responded, "That's not something that a network executive should be able to say anymore."
It was brilliant.
Yes, indeed. What was it about those programs, you think, that changed the network? Do those shows reflect the changes in us, or is it really a vision of someone that can change a network and its personality?
Well, I think America wants and needs that kind of collective experience of coming to the television set and watching and sharing. What was unique is that in the 90s at NBC with Must See TV, what we were able to do was bring the audience one network, one night for one decade. And it was a celebration of outstanding comedy and powerful drama. And America, well, we still come to network television. We come to cable television, but we come when we want and how we want. So today, if you want a big audience, you've got to go to live event television, the Super Bowl, the World Series, the Oscars. Those are things that gather millions and millions and millions of people to be united. Uniquely, what we were able to do with the quality of those programs was say, America, you want to be a part of this conversation. Don't miss out, because if you go to work tomorrow, you don't want to be left out of the equation. Don't go to the water cooler and have not participated. And that kind of experience was unique and a lot of fun.
What is fascinating about must-see television, that Thursday night lineup, is it generated more revenue than all other six nights of the programming combined on the NBC television network. So it was a powerhouse. At what point?
It was indeed. We were actually in a strategic meeting with GE, and one of the finance guys looked at us and said, "You need more Thursdays." I looked and I just said, "Very well, that's what we'll do."
So how do you get to that point where even in your mind it becomes must-see television?
Well, originally, back in the 80s, kind of our in-house way of describing it was a night of bests. And what we attempted to do was take our best comedy, our best drama, and put them on Thursday night, make that a destination. And when we had a great pilot, we said, it goes to Thursday night. We would screen the entire pilot in the upfront presentations in New York. Those will happen yet again over the next couple of weeks. And we really would put as big a Klieg light as we possibly could on the quality of that product. The tracks were laid when we had The Cosby Show, and ultimately it was that show that turned the lights on for Cheers and finished the night with L.A. Law.
No. I better get dressed. Mrs. Davis will be here at any moment. Cliff, don't let Rudy get up from that table till she's cleaned her plate.
I'm not eating them.
All right. Then just sit here.
How long?
For how long? Until you eat them. All I can say is I remember a little girl and she wouldn't eat her vegetables, and the parents said, well, you're just going to sit there until you eat them. And she saw her friends growing up. People were going to college. She was still sitting there in the same clothes she had on when she was 5 years old. Now, are you going to eat them?
No.
All right, then just sit there, all right? And don't try to hide them, because if you try to hide them, I'm coming back and I'm going to check
my
teeth. Right.
That night of best, that strategy was in place as we hit the 90s and we had Mad About You and Seinfeld and Frasier and ER. We just had to label it. We needed a brand for what was going on at NBC. And in the bowels of the promotion department, they said, what about must-see TV? And John Miller, who was running advertising and promotion, said, I like it, it rhymes.
It is interesting to me, one of the fascinating aspects of must-see TV and that lineup change is that you have a great show, say like Cheers or The Cosby Show, and then it goes away. Inevitably, it's brilliant, and then there is an end. And then you were able to find replacements for these shows that generated enough buzz, and then ultimately these programs would become classics in and of themselves. You talk about Seinfeld in the book, one of the lowest testing pilots ever in the history of television, but you have confidence in it that it can work in that spot.
Well, when the research was presented, which happened to be on my birthday, it was just a kick in the gut. We had never heard or seen a research document like that, and it scared us. And we enjoyed the pilot. There was a real appreciation for what Jerry and Larry had accomplished. And yet, that research document was so damning. That year, we picked up The Nut House and Sister Kate. Now, Joe, you probably haven't heard of those because they didn't last very long.
I have, but I'm a geek. But yes, but they were not popular programs.
That's right. And America told us exactly that. We took a deep breath. We were virtually out of money because we had made bad decisions. And I ended up stealing from advertising. I stole from the specials department. We did one less Bob Hope special, and we made 4 episodes of Seinfeld. Jerry asked me, has there ever been a successful series coming out of a 4-episode launch? And I said, I don't know, Jerry. And he said, okay, well, we'll make them.
Mm.
And thank goodness we stepped up. We ordered 4, then we ordered 13. Originally, when it went on as a series, we were Wednesday nights at 9 up against Home Improvement, and Seinfeld got killed. But we still loved it, and we just couldn't let go. So our patience was rewarded. And ultimately, not only did it take the place of Cheers Thursday nights at 9 o'clock, but it eclipsed Cheers' performance.
Good afternoon. One large crab bisque to go. Red.
Beautiful. You're pushing your luck, little man.
Sorry. Thank you. Thank you.
Hey there. One mulligatawny and, what is that right there? Is that lima bean?
Yes.
Never been a big fan. you know what? Has anyone ever told you look exactly like Al Pacino? You know, scent of a woman? Hoo-ah! Hoo-ah!
Very good. Very good. You know something? No soup for you! Come back 1 year!
We're going in a linear fashion here, and I don't want to take us off track, but I am interested in, when we're talking about successful situation comedies, as the title of the book implies, inside the rise and fall of must-see TV, there was a fall. What is it about our current state of television that does not support situation comedies such as the ones that we saw during this era of the 90s, to allow them to be as popular as they once were and to allow that writing and the stars to be what they were.
Well, I agree with you, Joe. They were pretty spectacular shows. And the combination of having all that quality on one night, on one network, that'll never be duplicated. And you'll never get a third of the country tuning in each and every week to watch. Because the world changed. Technology has changed. We still look for a shared experience. Audiences want that. But instead of a approximately 50-channel universe, there's now a 200-channel universe. And instead of waiting to go to the water cooler, go to the coffee station and share, here's what I saw last night on Seinfeld. I can't believe it. Well, today there's Twitter, there's blogs, there's all instant feedback. And in a 200-channel universe, the audience has been chopped up and sliced and diced in different ways. There are wonderful, wonderful choices out there. There were before must-see TV, and there are today. I think Modern Family is a brilliant comedy. And for me, that's must-see. But you don't get an entire network putting together a lineup that has the kind of power and the ability to unite an audience the way must-see TV did.
For the Academy Awards, we threw a movie-themed charades party.
The finger. The one finger. Pointing. The sky. Cloudy with the chance of the meatballs.
This means one word.
Meatballs!
I don't know. Is it a movie? What are you doing? Oh my God, he's having a seizure. Sweetie.
Shawshank Redemption. Come back to the Five and Dime. Jimmy Dean. Music Man. Ooh, Brokeback Mountain.
Oh, jeez. We're never doing that again.
It seems as though, and Modern Family is a wonderful example, because it comes away from the traditional before a live studio audience situation comedy. And the comedies that we saw in Seinfeld and Frasier and Friends and Will and Grace and Mad About You and Third Rock and Cheers and The Cosby Show were all very successful studio audience situation comedies. We look at now Two and a Half Men, we look at Big Bang Theory and perhaps How I Met Your Mother, and these are shows that are kind of the last gasp of that type of comedy. And I'm curious as to what happened, and arguably I would say, I know those shows have fans, but to me they're nowhere near the quality or the longevity or the brilliance of those classic sitcoms that I mentioned a moment ago.
Well, Joe, I take that as an enormous compliment, having had a little something to do with helping the magic happen in those classic shows. I think the audience started the shift, and certainly developers scratched their head and said, okay, when we watch the multicams, who are those people laughing? Are those strangers in my living room? I think the key here is that a Modern Family is able to be a really broad-based, something-for-everyone comedy. And while Friends looked at 20-somethings as they ventured into the world and knowing everything that they were up against, it was certainly a lot easier if you did it with your friend, right? But what we found, interestingly, is the way those shows were written, that it was so inviting to every generation. We found by the second year of Friends, nearly 25% of the audience was 50 plus. And we said, well, why are they watching? Well, we were all young at some point in our lives, and those experiences were so universal. And I think part of the problem in shows today not being able to reach any of the heights that we reached, one is just the relatability, the access points in the material, and the other, of course, is the world change. There's just more choices than ever before.
So you were in an I Hate Rachel club?
Yes, he was.
No.
So who else was in this club?
Actually, there was also that exchange student from Thailand, but
I don't think he knew what it was.
So, Ross, we went out for 2 years, and you never told me you were in an I Hate Rachel club.
You went out with her? We had a pact.
That was in high school. It's not like it was binding forever.
Then why did it have the word eternity in it?
Okay, Monica, did you know about this? I swear I didn't. Hey, is that why you guys used to go up to your bedroom and lock the door?
Yeah.
A little relieved, I gotta say.
Look, Rachel, I'm sorry, okay? I was a stupid kid, okay? The only reason I joined... Co-founded the club was that I was insanely in love with you. Obviously, I didn't handle it very well. But if you think about it, the I Hate Rachel Club was really the I Love Rachel Club.
Except that it was really the I Hate Rachel Club.
There's some things that you take for granted, and I think you illustrate this in the book very nicely about how one decision really can make an impact. And you talk in the book about making a bet on Jennifer Aniston in Friends. She was contracted to CBS, and you make this gamble. And you'll never know, obviously, but if you put another actress into that role, and certainly not to diminish the talents of the other five, would it have been as special? And it's that type of detail, it seems, that is necessary to have the success that you had.
Well, I think so. It's doing 1,000 things correctly, getting lucky, and in the case of a cast like the Friends ensemble, unbelievable alchemy, an incredible bond. We had Jennifer Aniston in a bad version of Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Right.
We, of course, tried the show without John Hughes as the showrunner. and it didn't work, but Jennifer certainly caught our eye. And then we did some bad pilots with her, but we still believed in Jennifer. And she was under contract to CBS, as you said. And I thought, oh, my God, what am I going to do? We really don't have the rights moving forward to Jennifer. She actually contractually was guesting because they had her in first position, and I rolled the dice for millions of dollars of making episodes that ultimately we may have had to reshoot. Her show wasn't picked up, and it all worked out, but I don't think it would have been the same. Absolutely not. Would not have been the same without her.
The book is an oral history. Your voice is throughout the book and many others who were part of this time and this era. One of the people who comes out to me as just a patron saint of someone who really is just incredible is Jim Burrows.
There is no better director. Jimmy Burrows was one of the creators, executive producer, and directed almost every single episode of Cheers. He also directed the pilot of Night Court. Then we put Friends in his hands to help bring that to life, and also Will and Grace. And he executive produced and directed every single episode of Will and Grace. Jimmy Burrows has actually put almost 60 series on the air, pilots to series. And that is a record that no one will come close to, ever.
Now, remember, let each gesture tell a little story, the way she does, okay?
I'll never be like her.
Well, of course not. She's one of the great artists of all time. But we're not going to honor her by quitting, okay? Now, come on, let's go again.
Okay.
5, 6, 7, 8. Oops, I did it again. I played with your heart, got lost in the game. Oh, baby, baby, yes, it's totally it. It's so good, yeah. I can actually feel the spirit of Brittany in the room. And you were not that innocent.
It seems that he understood the characters. He understood the shows and what people wanted to see. There's somewhere in the book when you're talking about Friends, he says that we knew that Ross and Rachel were the guts of the show. And it was that realization that helped drive the entire program.
It did. When I went back and looked at the initial pitch document for Friends, and then 10 years later, looking at where we ended up with Ross and Rachel, finally ready to declare their love and accept one another. That thread was all in the initial pitch, because Marta Kaufman and David Crane understood where their show lived. And the nod goes to them for everything that they brought to bear for 10 years of outstanding comedy. And Jimmy Burrows, his magic, his brilliance, is not only what he does with the actors, but he is able to talk to the writers and say, give me this, give me this. So Jimmy is working both with the talent in front of the camera, and then he's working brilliantly with the talent behind the camera. And I think that's what makes him so unique. He gets the best out of both sides of that equation.
You currently run your own television production company. Is life much different being on that side of the equation?
Well, let me say this. I don't get to make the final decision, and I don't think I'll ever get used to that. it is very different. Instead of juggling 100-plus balls in the air, I juggle more of like a dozen, and I have a deeper, closer relationship to the product. I live and breathe what I work on day and night instead of presiding over a massive amount of it. So I like that kind of quality that I get to do. The frustrating thing is, wait a second, I don't get to make the final decision on whether this gets made. I don't think I'll ever get used to that.
So currently, what are the Warren Littlefield shows?
Well, my last show that was on ABC didn't last very long. It was called My Generation. It was an hour. It was on Thursday night at 8, and Big Bang just put it to rest. But I was proud of the work, and I'm busy developing both half hours and hours. I play in the scripted world, not the reality world. That's where I'm really comfortable, and that's where I focus my energy.
Do you think reality television will ever die? Because we called it a fad 10 years ago, 15 years ago.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, it won't die, but it's a part of the diet and a part of the menu of what a network, whether it's a broadcast network or a cable network, it's a part of all of their diets. It's not as white-hot a genre because there was this sense that no matter what you throw on there, it'll do well. And I think ultimately the audience kind of is able to discriminate. And it's never a bad bet when you bet on respecting the audience. I think that was one of the keys to our successes at NBC. Respect the audience. Quality audience will come if you give them quality entertainment. And there's some wonderful reality shows that celebrate the discovery of talent. And then there's also a bunch of crappy ones, and we won't talk about those.
When you see the situation that NBC is currently in and the struggles that they have, does that, in your opinion, come out of a current lack of respect for the audience?
Well, this is a different administration, and there's different ownership of the network. So I think Bob Greenblatt, who did some wonderful work over when he was running Showtime, I think Bob is a smart broadcast executive. He's a good developer. And nothing lasts forever. You know, the must-see era was remarkable. My book is a celebration of that. If you love those shows, then I think you'll really enjoy the book. But NBC now has to take a deep breath, ask themselves, as we did, who are we? Who do we want to be? And then you execute that on a night-by-night strategy. It takes luck. It takes skill. And their belief in Smash is a step in the right direction. And on Thursday night, they need a Modern Family the way Bill Cosby turned the lights on for Cheers. They need their Modern Family to help some of their other product. And I'm sure that's their quest.
The book is endlessly enjoyable. It is Top of the Rock, Inside the Rise and Fall of Must-See TV. It's published by Doubleday. Warren Littlefield is the former NBC president of entertainment, and a great pleasure to speak with you, sir. I've been a fan of your work for a long time, and I thank you very much for being with us.
Joe, it's absolutely my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, it's Top of the Rock, Inside the Rise and Fall of Must-See TV. Warren Littlefield is the author. The book is published by Doubleday. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.